and introduce your bill to us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Cliff Zahner, District 22, Woodburn and North Salem. Let me get out my cheaters. House Bill 3136, very simply stated, what we're trying to do here is let our boxing commission really concentrate on trying to bring in professional boxing. So in order to do that, by removing amateur boxing from the influence of the Oregon State Boxing Commission, we'd be freeing them to focus on promoting professional boxing. It's similar to 3581A, which removed wrestling from the authority of the Boxing Commission because they were not professional athletes. And if you read the bill, it's very simple. It just eliminates all the amateur boxing or any other amateur sport from the authority of the commission. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, you were pretty brief. When you say read the bill, you're talking about the Dash 2 amendments, is that correct?
Right.
Sorry. That's really what you would like us to be considering here?
Yes, it's a gut and stuff.
Okay.
And if you read it, the promoting, conducting, or maintaining of boxing and wrestling matches, contests, or exhibitions when conducted by educational institutions, the Oregon National Guard units, United States Amateur Boxing Federation, or any other amateur athletic organization duly recognized by the Oregon State Boxing and Wrestling Commission shall be exempt from the licensing and bonding provisions of this chapter. And it goes all the way down to ultimately say any contest, match, or exhibition between persons who are not professional boxers and who do not receive any monetary remuneration, purse, or other financial compensation is exempt from the Boxing Commission.
Any questions for Representative Zahner? Representative, I do have another one. When I was in high school, I was guilty of boxing in some smokers. And as far as I knew, those were not under the auspices of the Boxing Commission. Of course, this was in Washington State as opposed to Oregon State. Are things such as smokers currently under the auspices of the Boxing Commission, or are they exempt?
Mr. Chair, like tough guy boxing and that type of thing? Or
I suppose that would be tough guy, yeah.
I think Jim can relate to that, but I think it probably is. I think all boxing of all type at the moment, I think, is under the boxing.
Okay, so under this bill, then things like high school smokers, college smokers, fraternity smokers, tough guy contests, that sort of thing would all become exempt and not be covered under the Boxing Commission.
Right.
Okay. And is that the intent that you're trying to get to? Representative,
yes,
do you have a question?
I just had one question. What do you define as professional versus amateur? What is it paid?
Yeah, I think remuneration, just like it says. You know, professional boxers get money and you get paid. So if you're putting on an event where there's no money involved, that wouldn't be classed as professional.
Follow-up, Representative Kitts.
Representative Zahner, what do you think is the biggest inhibitor? I mean, it seems like Portland is not a main venue. Oh, we did have Roy Jones Jr. here, and I thought that was great. But what is prohibiting our state from being a major draw?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kitts, I think in the years past, I think they had a real, real tough commission that, at least on the information I get, that required some stringent testing and some other drug tests that other states weren't requiring, and I think that was inhibited some of that. And I think the rules are pretty consistent now, and they have brought in some fights lately, and I just want to free them up to really concentrate on bringing in some real good fights, you know, Tanya Harding and some other professionals. But professional fighters, professional fighters, as opposed to high school or tough guy or some of these other things that aren't really professional fighters. And so I want them to concentrate on that because I think it will bring more revenue to the state.
Okay.
That's my intent there.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative Zahner?
Next, you'll want to regulate demolition derbies.
Okay, Representative, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have with us Jim Cassidy. And, Jim, you want to come up? Looks like Jim brought the whole commission.
No.
Oh, I'm just kidding.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Cassidy. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon State Police Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and I'm here this morning to oppose the proposed amendment of House Bill 3136. On my right is Dr. Reels, who is the commission chairman, physician for all professional and the amateur sports that we regulate. And to my left is Wally Jorgensen, who is a trainer and coach of amateur boxers, and also he has some professional boxers that he trains and coaches also. I'm not going to take up too much of your time this morning. I have a video that I wanted you to look at, and then I will briefly touch on some points in that video. I might reflect to Representative Zahner's statement about amateur boxing in colleges and high schools, things like that. We do not regulate smokers or anything with such. That is strictly, they are exempt from licensing and bonding through the Oregon State Boxing and Wrestling Commission. As he radiated to Oregon National Guard units, United States Amateur Boxing Federation, and any other organization that is duly recognized by the state of Oregon. With having said that, I would ask you to watch the video, and then we will comment on the video. Is that all right, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
Representative Kitts.
Just before we go any further, can I don't want to show my age here. Can somebody tell me what a smoker is?
A smoker is generally held by high schools or fraternities, college fraternities and colleges and that sort of thing. And they're multiple bouts, generally, and they usually put out the y'all come sign. Anybody can enter if they pay whatever their fee is, if there is a fee. And they generally have to sign a waiver to make sure that they don't to waive any kind for injury and that sort of thing. And they're generally either 3 3-minute rounds or 3 2-minute rounds, and some go as low as 3 1-minute rounds. And they usually require, like at the high school level, they generally require either a 12 or 16 ounce glove.
And the chair participated in these?
Yes, I did.
I vaguely remember reading about these in my history book.
This is why I wear my nose over by my left ear.
Most of the tougher guys on the committee participated in those, Derek.
Okay, let's move on. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Tonight on Real Sports. After several fatalities in just the past few months, there are a growing number of calls to ban those amateur fight shows known as tough man competitions.
If you're going to say that there's something wrong with tough man, then there's something radically wrong with boxing. If you're going to stop one, you must stop all boxing.
At an ever-increasing rate, those parents dissatisfied with their children's success and fields of play are actually suing coaches, schools, and refs.
Every parent thinks that their child is the next Tiger Woods or Venus Williams.
So if my kid didn't make the team, it's the coach's fault. And therefore, I have to sue somebody.
Absolutely.
Ricky Henderson feels there is still a lot of baseball left in his 44-year-old body, and he's willing to play for minimum salary. But as this season begins, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer in search of a job.
I think I want it as bad as I can taste it based on it because I want to prove to myself that I can still play and maybe prove to baseball that I can still play.
In a game that requires its players to literally use their heads, concussions are a frequent and serious problem. No one seems sure just what, if anything, can be done about it.
Everybody looks at football as the sport that is the epitome of concussion. Soccer and football are about the same rate.
And now, from the HBO Real Sports Studio in New York, your host, Brian Gumbel.
Good evening, and welcome to Real Sports, where we begin tonight with a look at those contests known as tough man competitions. Part boxing and part wrestling, they're essentially cheap entertainment vehicles that appeal to the basest elements of human nature. The fully willing participants in these tough man shows typically have very little boxing experience or fighting skill, but they get into a ring and duke it out in bouts that generally degenerate into free-for-alls that barely resemble the sweet science. Tough man competitions are so crude that they might also be funny if no one got hurt. But as Frank DeFord reports, that's clearly not the case.
Ever wonder who the toughest guy in town is? Well, in dozens of places across the country, they actually find out who that honor belongs to. Towns like St. Joseph, Michigan, where if you leave the main drag and drive through a cornfield in the outskirts, you'll come across something called a tough man contest.
I'm a used car dealer.
I'm a welder. I'm an outside sales rep.
I'm a farmer. That's why they call me the haymaker.
It's a contest where local barroom brawlers duke it out for the chance to be named the toughest man in town.
Fight in front of all your family, all of your friends, and a lot of your enemies, too, you know, in a small town. That's going to come out, too, especially being a used car dealer.
Do you fight as a general rule, and have you golden gloves or anything like that?
Nothing like that. I just, you know, a lot of bar brawls. But
a lot of bar brawls.
Yeah, they put you in jail for those nowadays.
Yeah.
Loosely based on the rules of boxing, with headgear and oversized gloves, fighters pummel their way through three frenzied one-minute rounds. Win and you earn the right to fight again and again in a two-day event like this one.
Speed, movement, stances, there's a lot more to it than you really think.
6'7", 325-pound Jason Piles, a.k.a. the Pile Driver, entered his second Tough Man event in January.
Why do you think so many guys sign up then?
They're just, you know, old high school or college athletes that just want to get a little active, or, you know, maybe got some ego guys that want to just go fight, think they're the toughest thing since, you know, whatever.
And if you want to get in the ring, all you have to do is show up, get a cursory physical from a tough man doctor, sign a waiver of liability, and pony up the $50 entry fee. Yes, you actually have to pay for the privilege of possibly getting your block knocked off.
Where else can you go for $50, get in the ring, show people how tough you are without going to jail? In a fight.
I don't have any more BS. Are you ready to get it on? Let's hear it all. Hell yeah!
Art Dorr is the original tough man, a wealthy construction and demolition executive from Bay City, Michigan, who in 1979 came up with the tough man concept. This year, Dorr says his company will stage more than 100 events in 40 different states.
When a guy wins tonight here in St. Joseph, Michigan, what's he going to win?
Nothing.
Didn't get anything.
He's going to get a tough man jacket.
A tough man jacket.
He's going to get bragging rights. Toughest man in town.
Equal parts P.T. Barnum, Don King, and Jerry Springer.
What are you waiting for? Go in there and knock his ass
out. Dorr knows who his fans are and how to keep them coming back.
So let's raise some hell and have some fun. What do you say?
We entertain the crowd. They come here and have a good time. They come to the fights to see a knockout.
They come to see blood.
Sure they do.
Blood and guts.
Absolutely.
But tough man is not just a bloody good time. The spectacle has always been under fire from some doctors and state officials. But in the last few months, three tough men have been killed in the ring. So it's been getting tougher for Art Dorr to justify his own neighborhood brand of fun and games.
I feel that if it had been all the things that have been in place,
safety-wise, my son would be here today.
Lila Liggins was with her son, Tony, ringside last September at a Tough Man contest in Boise, Idaho, when another son, Arthur, a 44-year-old railroad conductor, was knocked out.
He had three fights, the first night and two the second night. I don't think your body can recuperate that fast. But he took a blow to the back of the neck, and looked like a very light blow, but it was to the back of the neck in a sensitive area, I guess, and rendered him unconscious. Well, I realized it was trouble immediately once he hit the surface.
Both Arthur's mother, who was a nurse, and his brother, who was a professional boxer, were shocked at what happened after Arthur went down.
There was no movement, and I couldn't see that anyone was really helping him. There were people around him, but they weren't helping him. But I jumped into the ring, and I seen the look on his face was out-of-it stare, breathing, sporadic.
I was in the ring then, and I said, you guys have any oxygen? What's going on? You know. I said, where's the doctor?
It was kind of like confusion around him laying there, trying to figure out what they were going to do. They were asking each other what they should do. Some other gentleman moved to where his leg area was and elevated his feet for one reason I couldn't understand.
I'm helpless, kneeling there with my son. So they said, well, the paramedics are here. Well, they're outside.
To get in the ring and watch your brother in that position, and you can't help him, and no one else appears that they can help him either. I didn't understand it. Couldn't understand.
The next day, Arthur Liggins died. The coroner found evidence that Liggins had likely sustained a brain injury from a previous fight in that same event and re-injured it that night.
Who are the doctors that, do you have like a stable of doctors, or do you pick somebody up in a town?
Usually we come back to the same areas, and we have different doctors in those areas that come in.
One of your critics says you've used veterinarians.
He lies.
Chiropractors?
No, it's ridiculous.
You use regular MDs.
Doctors, yes.
A man named Art Liggins, as you know, was killed in Boise, Idaho. Both his mother and brother swear that the moment he went down, there was no doctor there whatsoever.
A guy may not have a sign on the back that says doctor, but the fellow, the doctor, was in the ring. I don't recall his name right now, but I could certainly tell you who it is. Was on top of that action immediately.
There was a doctor at the Liggins fight, as Doerr claims, but Real Sports discovered he is, in fact, a chiropractor, who said in a phone conversation that he did all he could that day to save Liggins' life.
My brother was a grown man. He knew what he was getting into, and I think he just didn't know that if something should happen, that he wouldn't have the proper medical attention.
Incredibly, on the very same day of the Liggins tragedy,
a College Station man fights for his life tonight after receiving severe head trauma at a boxing match this weekend.
Another tough man was fatally injured in Texas. And just 3 months after those two deaths,
how many people have to die in this, you know, before they stop it?
Jason Piles, the pile driver, ended up killing his last tough man opponent, 31-year-old Scott Wood. Something Pyle says never should have happened.
We both know it was an important fight to both of us. We're wrestling right through him a couple of times.
You were manhandling him.
Yeah, completely. And the second round got a little bit more physical. And more punches were thrown and bigger punches were thrown. And he was on his hands and knees, and you can see on the video that he's trying to pull his mouth guard out. And then at that time he said, hey, I've had enough. I can't handle this guy anymore. I've had enough. You know, keep this guy off. And I thought, okay, the referee obviously heard it. He's going to stop the fight. And we come back out into the third, and I thought, I guess we're going on. You know, this is weird to me. And so I thought, well, it's either, you know, get my head kicked in or, you know, fight back. So we both had to fight out. And then in the third round, he'd ask to stop the fight again. He's had enough.
Shortly after he stepped out of the ring, Wood collapsed. He never fully regained consciousness. And 3 weeks later, Scott Wood died.
When you hit seven deaths, Jack Kevorkian hit seven deaths, and in the state of Michigan, they locked him up.
Dr. Stuart Kirschenbaum, who was boxing commissioner in Michigan for 12 years, has tracked seven deaths over the years to Art Doerr's tough man.
Art Doerr does not put a gun to these guys' heads. They must know, you know, a fight's a tough thing, what they're getting into.
They don't understand. I mean, these guys are unconditioned, untrained. untrackable. Those are your three main things. Poor medical examinations or non-existent medical examinations. No follow-up medical examinations. No licensing of these contestants so we know who they are.
And that's just the beginning for Kirschenbaum. He's also concerned about anyone, trained or not, who must fight three or four times in little more than 24 hours, as Arthur Liggins had. And that's especially considering the potential for mismatches. There are only two divisions in the heavyweight range from 185 up to 400 pounds.
There is a difference between a trained boxer and some guy who comes in off the street, out of shape, fat, and not prepared to box.
Just because you're fat don't mean you're not in shape to fight 3 one-minute rounds.
How do you match up these guys?
We match them up as close as we can to their weight and their height and so forth.
So you try to get them as close as you can.
Yeah, sure. If there's a mismatch, that's why we have a referee and we stop the fight.
Well, Jason Pyle says that his opponent was begging the referee, please stop the fight.
No.
And ended up dead.
No, of course not. That is not correct at all. The referee stops a lot of fights that they don't even want stopped.
The referee did not return repeated phone calls from Real Sports, but has stated in a published report that he believes Wood was not asking him to stop the fight.
People die in the ring. Do you bear any responsibility?
I bear a responsibility to give them a safe place to perform. I have a responsibility to inform them of the dangers. I have a responsibility to give them a physical and to follow all of the rules, and that's what we do.
But what are the regulations that Dorr must follow? Well, it depends what state you're in. Take the states where the three recent deaths occurred. Idaho has no rules when it comes to tough man. In Texas, the Boxing Commission regulates these events, with sanctioned refs and doctors. In Dorr's home state of Michigan, the law says he can essentially regulate himself.
Do you think the legislators should wake up and say, what the hell's going on here in Michigan? What's going on here in the rest of the country? With tough man, if you cannot regulate something and enforce those regulations, then abolish it.
While four states do ban tough man events, several others have laws pending. And in January, Nevada's Athletic Commission decided not to renew Art Dorr's license, citing concerns over the number of consecutive matches for each fighter, as well as the fighter's medical condition prior to and after the fights.
Nevada's a very good commission.
And they banned you.
Yes, they did. Well, they banned me. We were there, we're out, we're in, we're out. Talk about political, well, depends who's in charge, I guess.
Whatever the politics, as long as average Joes still want to prove who's the toughest guy in their neck of the woods, as long as their friends and family will pay to watch it, Dorr's traveling show will, it seems, go on.
Trash and barbaric is what one of the commissioners described you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that he pretty well described boxing. It's a rough, tough game. Yeah, it's barbaric. But is barbaric bad? I don't know that. I think that maybe a little bit of barbaric ain't too bad.
Frank, it's pretty easy to paint Art Dorr as the villain of this piece. About how much does he make off these competitions every year?
Well, I don't know, but you got to start with the fact that he has no talent.
Hi, and Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We're not here to oppose smokers and things like that. The amendment says, Representative Zahner said, any contest, match, or exhibition between persons who are not professional boxers, who do not receive any monetary remuneration, purse, or financial compensation. Tough man, although he says is amateur, they do receive money for these bouts. They had a show here in Salem 2 years ago. Art Dorr put in a promoter application, and before we had the promoter application completely processed, he held his matches in the Salem Armory here in Salem. He was later fined for holding a contest without a promoter's license and bonding issues. Bouts are held for, I've given the committee a little packet here that I have outlined some of the things that I'm going to touch on. Bouts in tough man competitions for men are held in two divisions. Lightweight, 160 pounds to 184 pounds. Heavyweight, 185 to 400 pounds. Women, that's right, tough men appreciate a good cat fight, competes in an open weight class. By the end of the second day of competition, only one man and one woman are left standing, proudly wearing the illustrious Tough Man Championship jacket. They advance to regional tournaments where they vie for hard heads for a berth in a $100,000 purse. Tough Man World Championship aired live on pay-per-view. So these people are actually, in a sense, professionals. However, tough men, they wear protectors. Even tough guys and gals need protection. No contestant can enter the ring without donning a 16-ounce glove, headgear, mouthpieces, and groin protectors. I might add that the headgear that they wear is passed on from fighter to fighter to fighter. They only have two sets of headgear. On the next page, you'll notice a 26-year-old father of two died last week after suffering head injuries during a Tough Man boxing competition. That was September 22, 2002. Michael Kuhn from College Station was injured during a Tough Man match September 15, 2002. He was in intensive care for almost a week when he died last Friday. Art Liggins, a 44-year-old fighter, died from head injury suffered during a Tough Man fight in Idaho the same night that Kuhn was injured. On the next page, we have promoters of the original Tough Man contest call it the safest form of fighting event, claiming their bouts are less dangerous than professional boxing, Olympic qualifiers, and ultimate fighting matches. USA Boxing says Tough Man puts unskilled fighters at risk by letting them step in the ring with little or no training and limited physical conditioning. For the most part, all fighters have to enter is pay a $50 fee, sign a waiver releasing Tough Man and his parent company, Adorable Promotions, from the liability and show up. This does not release the venue or the state from a possible lawsuit. At least 8 deaths have been linked to Tough Man contests since they began in 1979. Art Liggins, as I said, a 44-year-old fighter, made a bid for the U.S. Olympics boxing team in 1970. Died Saturday, and the same night Kuhn was injured as a result of head injuries. Now there have been 9 deaths so far. But since the contest began, there have been deaths in Pennsylvania, Kansas, Alabama, Louisiana, 2 in Michigan, additional 2 deaths within the last week.
Jim, I'm going to ask you not to go through and read all of the highlighted things. We can see
All right. We
can see the areas that you've highlighted here, and we have the testimony in front of us.
All right.
Is there, I guess, the other two of you want to say anything?
Dr. Reels is a ringside physician and also the head of medical staff for the state of Oregon.
Just to put this in a different perspective for you, my name is Dr. Reels. I'm a general surgeon practicing in Florence, and I'm a delegate of the American Association of Ringside Physicians for the United States. I've been involved in amateur boxing, U.S. Olympic boxing matches, and multiple professional world championship fights, and known nationally. The state of Oregon has indeed had the best rules and regulations in the last 10 years, and therefore we have not had many boxing matches. But the ones that we do have are very safe, and our rules are well known throughout the United States as being even better than the ones in Nevada. Our main goal is to provide safe public venues for the boxer and for the public. Now, what I want to put into perspective is that amateur boxing is controlled by the USA Amateur Boxing Association. And this is a United States organization that prepares individuals in each state to compete for the U.S. Olympic team. And they have their own regulations and sanctioning bodies. We do not regulate them. As far as smokers in this state, there probably is no smokers occurring at high school and in college venues at all. Tough man situations that occur in this state were probably considered a criminal event. If you were to go outside in the street and fight with someone, you'd get arrested. Our contention is that if the tough man has no rules or regulations or monitoring, it's going to set a public problem in that most of these people that participate will not have insurance coverage, will wind up in the emergency rooms, and it will be our responsibility to care for them. And that's almost 100% of these people that participate. All our professional boxers are insured, have insurance policies. They are nationally known in the data banks by the federal government. We know what their boxing rate is, how many times they've been knocked out, when their last fight was, and each physician in each state can determine whether that fight should go on. We have had fights here that I have canceled because of the statistics on the data bank. And it helps us prevent deaths in the ring. We are now able to identify, as we begin to make boxing safer, that a certain amount of fights at a certain amount of age will produce a certain amount of injury. In tough man contests, there is no regulation, there's no monitoring, and if we allow this to go unregulated, we will be stuck with the health issues that are presented. Furthermore, they do not have to comply with the HIV testing, the hepatitis testing. Whenever there is blood used in sports, those tests are very important to protect the public that attends, as well as the fighter. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Wally Jorgensen, introduced earlier.
My name's Wally Jorgensen. I run a boxing club here in Salem, and I've been involved in boxing since 1957. And I travel all over, halfway around the world with fighters. I've been around a long time. And I went to the tough man match they had here in Salem. One kid asked me to come down and wrap his hand, so I did. Another kid asked me to work his corner. I don't even know his name, but he was alone. He gets flattened out the first thing in the fight. It was the last fight of the night on a Friday night. I'm looking around, where the hell's the doctor? And there's some guy putting stuff in his bag. He's going to leave. So I said, get up here, you know. So the guy comes up. He said, well, what do you want me to do? Obviously, he was not a doctor. A doctor would not ask me, what should I do? Anyway, they had packed the kid out to the hospital. I don't know what happened to him, but he definitely had a concussion. He turned gray. When you turn gray, something's going wrong. The kid was Mexican. You know, and there's no rules. There's nothing. I couldn't believe it. Years ago, we had tough man fights in the state, but they were regulated. This, there was nothing. I mean, hell, I've been in barroom fights that were nicer than these things. They were terrible. Guys in no shape. One kid walked out. He had no idea what to do. He stood there, and finally the other guy hit him, and that was it for him. You know, I mean, you can't put people in there like that. I mean, they got 8 or 9 deaths now. They're going to have a hell of a lot more, and the state will pay for them. There's no insurance, no nothing.
Do you know by any chance what their? I know that 8 or 9 deaths does sound like a lot, but on a national basis, and do you have any idea what their rate of death per 100,000 participants might be?
You have to speak louder, sir.
Do you have any idea what the number of deaths per 100,000 participants might be in a tough man versus in boxing in general?
I don't have any statistics on that, but I would say that professional amateur boxing is worldwide 12 months a year. It's year-round sport.
Right.
And I think we probably, in those two particular things, there's probably a hell of a lot less deaths in that than there would be in this, and along with other sports, because of the regulations that we have. I mean, these kids are checked, they're trained. I mean, you don't put a kid into a fight and his stomach is hanging out on the floor and, you know, he's obviously no condition, you know. You can't do that. And if you've ever fought before, you know within a minute or two, along with the excitement and everything that's happening, you've got no more air. It's done. You've got to be in good condition. And these guys are in no condition at all. It was awful. I couldn't believe it. One guy's 50 years old. I'm going to be 65, and I guarantee when I was 50, nobody's going to hit me with any gloves. It's all over with. You know, you don't go in there, especially when you're not trained or anything. But that's what they let go on, and it shouldn't be. It just shouldn't be.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'm not sure who's best qualified to answer this, but in the tape, it does make a distinction of the three places that they were featuring that had deaths, one of them being Texas College Station. They said that event actually was being regulated by the Texas Boxing Commission.
That is correct.
So, I mean, there's a commission which I grew up in Texas. I know that it's pretty active, and I would assume is considered at least a decent commission in how they regulate their fighting. I mean, we still had a death there. What do you think by having this continue to be regulated by the Oregon Boxing Commission? Do we have a guarantee that we're not going to have deaths?
No, there is no guarantee. I mean, the fact that there was a commission should make someone feel comfortable that there is regulation, there is monitoring, and therefore statistics can be added to it because they have to report that. Boxing is dangerous, even professional and regulated boxing. But we're just beginning now to figure out how we can make it the safest. We know that in boxing, the rate of death is minimal. It's in brain injuries are in football and in soccer. Boxing has the highest rate of eye injury of any other sport. And so we focus a lot on eye injury, and we have found that the protective gear that the amateurs wear is detrimental, as is a 16-ounce glove. It's like being hit with a huge sledgehammer. It's better to have a smaller 8-ounce glove and no headgear because you can move your head and you don't constantly try to adjust your helmet and get hit as you're trying to do that. But we haven't convinced the amateur people yet that the helmet should be lost or have a better helmet. But if we have no commission, we're probably bound to have more injuries. And those injuries will not be protected.
I'm going to follow up.
Follow up, Representative Brzezinski, and then Representative Kipps.
Do we give a false reliance by having a commission as compared to not having a commission that someone who steps into the ring is going to be safer than what they may be without it? Considering, I mean, using the example in Texas, do you think that young man thought, because if he even thought about it, that it was a commission sanctioned event, that somehow they're going to be safer and then potentially place us in a more liable position?
Well, most of the individuals that participate in sports such as boxing have managers, and they're a protective mode even in this stopping a fight, you know, whereas these tough men have no managers or someone in the ring who could say, I think my fighter's had enough. But it's up to the commission that they should have the same standard rules that they have for professional boxing that they do for tough man. So maybe Texas didn't. Maybe they just said, well, this is something for us to regulate so we can collect a tax on it, but we won't add the same rules that we do to boxing. So I don't know.
Thank you.
Representative Kipps.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, Texas, their regulations aren't quite as strict as Oregon State's are, and the tough man contests are regulated a little bit different than their professional sports.
Thank you.
Representative Kipps?
Just trying to look where to begin here. I want to make sure that I understood you correctly when you made the assertion that you would encourage these folks not to wear headgear because they adjust it. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I disagree with you 100%. I wrestled all through college. When you don't wear headgear, my ears happen. You know, I think a lot of damage can be done without headgear. I'm proof.
I can tell on the right side.
Thanks. I wasn't very ambidextrous in my wrestling career. I shot to the right. Either that, or I got pounded on my head a lot. That being said, you know, as a youth growing up from ages 10 through probably 18 years old, we would wrestle various matches a day at weekend tournaments. And I'm sure Representative Avakian, who is also a wrestler, can attest to that. Mm-hmm. That's a 3-2-2. That's a 7-minute match. And we would wrestle upwards of 6 or 7 matches a day if you were good. Mm-hmm. So I did. I don't know if Representative Avakian did.
Your question is, we need to move on, folks.
He's so mad.
Your question is?
My question, and I say this because I'm going to support the bill, because I disagree with the arguments. While I understand that Mr. Doar may do some things that are questionable, and I would agree with that, I think we can regulate that. I don't think these people are professional. So I'm totally dismissed. This guy's smoking a cigarette before he goes out there and boxes. It's not exactly the epitome of a professional athlete. I think this is you don't regulate amateur wrestling. We wrestle several matches in a day at 7 minutes, not 3-1s. What's that?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
more than happy for clarification.
I can address that issue with you. I had 101 amateur fights, and I don't have a cauliflower ear. But I got hit. In wrestling, you don't get hit. There is a big difference in getting your ears rubbed across a canvas and things of this nature, as opposed to somebody hitting you. The wrestling is a far different sport, and you're well-conditioned athlete. You are also trained to wrestle for 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes. Boxing is altogether different. Someone is in front of you, hitting you, not trying to take you down to the mat.
Mr. Chair, I'll make it very quick, but I've got one question.
Okay.
Do you consider these participants, well, two-part, I guess. Do you consider these participants to be professional boxers? And then, second, are you asking us to allow this in Oregon but keep it under the commission, or are you asking us really to just ban it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buckian, all the commission is concerned with here is we're opposed of this portion of regulation 163210, which states any contest, match, or exhibition between persons who are not professional boxers and who do not receive monetary remuneration, purse, or financial compensation. We do not want that in the Oregon statute, because it allows anyone, not just Art Doar, anyone who wants to come in and put on a boxing show, they're entitled to do it.
Well, what I want to know is, do you consider these participants to be professional boxers or not?
Mr. Chair, and Representative McLaughlin, in this instance, this is why Art Doar did not get a promoter license 2 years ago, because the commission feels that these are professionals. When you're fighting for an end result of $100,000, plus the fact that most places have the eventual winner gets $1,000 after a two-day tournament, to me, this is professional. That is an enumeration. And this is what we had with Art Doar, the conflict with Art Doar. We consider these people professionals, even though they're not trained, they're not professional, as Representative Kitt said, smoking a cigarette, of course that's not professional. But with that being said, if this is passed, if this proposed amendment is passed, that means that anybody can come into the state and hold these kind of contests. And if they sign a waiver, that just allows the promoter to be off the hook, but it certainly doesn't allow the venue or the state to be off the hook. And who knows what a wrongful death, what the prize of what the state would have to pay. It could be in the millions of dollars.
I would submit two things. One is that if they do pay a person $1,000 as an end result at the end of their 2-day match, then that would be financial compensation, and they would not fit under this, and therefore they would have to apply for a license.
Correct.
So Art Dorr may still not be able to come into the state and stage one of these. My other thing is with regards to headgear. I just have a very quick question. Do the professionals still wear headgear when they spar?
Yes, they do.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Representative Mabry.
Are we in a work session?
We are in a work session.
Then, if I may, you know, we seem to be a nation and a world of competition. We lose, and you know, your goal of saving lives is commendable, and I agree with it. But we've lost amateur and professionals on the basketball court. On the football court, we seem to lose people climbing Mount Hood every year. We allow people to jump out of airplanes. We had bungee jumping at the state fair. I wouldn't do any of those things. But there are people that do. I could go on and on and on, and I won't. I could right now sign up for the Boston Marathon. I'd die before I got two miles, but nonetheless, I could do that. So I respectfully would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3136.
Okay. Representative Mabry, thank you, gentlemen. Very much appreciate it. Representative Mabry has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 3136. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pozanski.
I wonder if Representative Donner can come back up. I had a couple of questions based on what we've heard
Okay. Regarding
the dash twos. I'm not sure.
He can come back up.
Thank you. In the when we're looking at the bold in print on page one on line 32, 23, it says professional boxers and then it goes into the not receiving monetary remuneration or purse or other financial compensation. I'm wondering if we need the term professional boxers in there. Because what I'm wondering is if it seems to me that what you're trying to do is get to events that are not receiving any type of financial compensation. And if that's the case, it seems to me we've got a catch here because it says any contest, match, or exhibition between persons who are not professional boxers, then we have the conjunction and the money part. And I'm just wondering whether or not if we took the professional boxers, if that would still allow for what you're trying to capture of taking out of the Boxing Commission's authority.
Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski, Legislative Council came up with this wording and to try to solve the problem, and I really can't answer that. We spent a lot of time on this, and wish I had an answer for you.
Do we know if we have actual definition of professional boxers in the statutes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I do not know. We could consult the lawyers or Legislative Council, if you like. Yeah. Just a pure supposition, if I may, maybe Mr. Cassidy would know if it's possible that a professional boxer could fight a match without monetary remuneration.
I would think
maybe that, and that might necessitate.
That's not the intent. I don't think professional boxers fight not to make money and make a living.
I would imagine that that's probably one of the reasons why that is put in there is because if you're putting on an exhibition and you have a professional boxer that comes into a tough man contest and enters it, that would not, I don't think that would be meeting with what it is that the tough man contests are all about. So I would suggest that probably the term professional boxer needs to, if they do have a card, they're a professional boxer, and they do have a World Boxing Federation card. I think it's World Boxing Federation card. Then they should not be in these exhibitions.
Right, but if you take that out, I mean, the thing is to say they're not professional boxers.
Mm-hmm.
Are we saying that if they're not professional boxers and they receive some type of purse, they're going to be covered by the commission?
Well, the way I read this, any contest, match, or exhibition is not going to apply to any contest, match, or exhibition. If they're a professional boxer, they shouldn't be in this contest in any of these contests to begin with, and they are not going to receive any monetary anything worth monetary value. So I don't know whether that would
if they receive any money at all, the fight can't go on. There's no money, period, going to be involved.
Yeah, Representative Zonner, the only thing is the placement of the "and" after professional boxers, you know, as compared to maybe being an "or."
Uh-huh.
Because it seems to me we're all agreeing that professional boxers shouldn't be in this no matter what,
right,
period.
Right.
But then, to me, the "and" is actually saying as a modifier that they're professional boxers and they're not receiving financial compensation. That's the way I'm reading that sentence.
Oh, okay. I see what you're getting at.
And what I'm saying is that if that word at least changed "and" to "or," if we're trying to, one, keep professional boxers out of this, or if they're receiving some type of purse,
then they're going to fall under the auspices of the boxing commission.
Yeah. So could we solve it after this? Before it gets to the Senate, we make a change. I don't know all of.
We need to suspend the rules. Chair requests unanimous consent to suspend the rules to make a yes.
Before you do that,
okay.
I'm straining my memory back to the professional wrestling bill that we had, and looking at subsection one here. Did we do anything in that bill that would have taken the language "wrestling matches" away from the jurisdiction of the commission, or changed the name so that it's not the State Boxing and Wrestling Commission, which would necessitate a change to Section 1 here as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bakke, if I may, if in the event that there is language that was changed when the bill is heard in a Senate committee, they will draft conflict amendments necessary to pass that.
Yeah. Let me ask before I go ahead and go through the. Would members tend to agree that changing the "and" for an "or" might be a good idea, Representative Vavakian? I see your turning there.
I was thinking. I think that is the right thing to do. We're not professional boxers, or
we do not receive.
I suppose just by virtue of the bill itself, this is going to be limited to people who are, who would otherwise fall under a boxing commission type definition. So you're not going to get skiers or racquetball players or anything else of that sort. I say it because if you take out the "and," then you have any contest, match, or exhibition who do not receive monetary remuneration. And wondering if that gets us into other venues other than this type of a combatant venue.
But because it's specific to 463, 210.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know the rest of that. And if that limits it to what would, I guess, usually fall under the purview of the commission,
yeah,
if it would be boxers, then we're okay.
I think you're correct there. I don't think there would need to be a.
That being the case, I think Representative brings up a good point.
Okay. In that case, I'm going to ask Chair request unanimous consent to suspend the rules for purposes of making a conceptual amendment to the -2 amendments to House Bill 3136. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Przanski, you want to make your conceptual amendment, please?
My conceptual amendment would be on line 23 of page 1,
deleting the word and substituting the word or, O-R.
Okay. So Representative Vavakian, Representative Przanski moves conceptual amendment to remove and on line 23 and insert the word or, O-R. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Przanski, did you...
Oh, Representative Mabry?
We still have the motion before us now.
No,
to,
we'll need to amend the motion. Because it's adopting the dash two amendments as amended.
Okay, so what I need you to do, Representative, is amend your motion to adopt dash two amendments as amended, as conceptually amended.
And I would do that very thing.
Representative Mabry. Representative Mabry moves the adoption of the dash two amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 3136. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move approve House Bill 3136 as amended and send it to the House floor with due past recommendation.
Okay. Representative Mabry moves House Bill 3136 as amended to the floor with a due past recommendation. Is there any discussion, Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be voting against this motion today with all due respect to the esteemed colleague, Representative Zahner. We're hearing this bill today because it's being characterized as a very important piece of legislation. And as a response to the request of us representatives to find creative ideas to increase jobs and the revenue for the state, and this bill is being proposed as doing just that. And I honestly can't see how by removing amateur boxing from the influence of the Oregon State Boxing Commission and freeing them to focus on promoting professional boxing is the best use of our time and that will have the most positive impacts on Oregon. I can't vote in favor of this and actually, you know, put the idea out there that this is our best response to creative ideas to increase jobs and revenue for our state. So with all due respect, Representative Zahner, I will be voting against this today.
Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Gina, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye. House Bill 3136 is amended, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Zahner, would you like to carry it?
I sure will.
Great. Representative Zahner will carry the bill.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3136. I'm going to open wait a minute. He's not here yet. Let's go ahead and...
We have him coming down. We can also... Let's just do a little check.
Okay, let's do that. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3617. We're waiting for Representative Krupp to come in, but he has some amendments that we're going to distribute, and we can take a look at those while we're waiting for Representative Krupp to get here. I don't know if this does have subsequent referral. Yeah, it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Dash one amendment has in it is bill. Yes.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3617 has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. The bill authorizes issuance of lottery bonds to finance homeland defense projects. It appropriates the bond proceeds to the Office of Emergency Management.
I apologize. I have not had a chance to look at the amendments. We received them during the meeting today.
Okay.
And so
my understanding in talking, let me just take a shot at this. My understanding in talking with Representative Krupp was that he wanted to have these amendments so that he wanted to, the Department of Corrections was planning to sell the property out on the Mill Creek property. And, pardon?
Is this, Mr. Chair, is this for the BPSST?
No, I don't believe it is. I think it's to for whatever type of development the city of Salem may determine that they want in that area, if any. And what this would do is direct the Department of Corrections to sell the property, and that that the money would then go to the office of Emergency Management, and from there it would be utilized, put into a trust, and the proceeds from that could be utilized to pay for any additional FTE necessary for meeting some of the Homeland Defense purposes that the feds have passed. And so that's about all I know, because from our conversation with that. And I wonder if Representative is he on his way?
Chair, I've been informed by Representative Krupp that they are in the process of voting on a bill. We'll come down as soon as.
Okay, I'm going to recess this session then, and we're going to go on to Senate Bill 161. Patrick, you want to tell us a little bit about this bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill, or Senate Bill, I'm sorry, 3161, or 161A, prohibits state agencies other than the Department of Transportation from charging Commission for the Blind for costs of rent or utilities for their vending facilities operated by the Commission. The bill has no fiscal or revenue impact and passed the Senate on a 30-0 vote.
Okay. And we have Ray Milojevic. Is that correct? Where did Ray we're just kind of striking out here. The Commission for the Blind. Okay, well, let's see here. We have... We seem to be striking out. Harrison, don't go away. I'm going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 161, Gina. And we're going to wander back into... Hang tight, Harrison, if you would for a moment, please.
He's walking in.
Mr. Milojevic is walking through the
okay.
Door.
Okay. Then I'm going to, and let's see if. Okay. Mr. Milojevic, and I know I'm just butchering your name, and I apologize for that. I'm going to take us out of recess in Senate Bill 161, and. Maybe you could go ahead and sit down and give us your testimony on this bill and tell us why it's necessary.
Okay. My name is Ray Milojevic. I'm the director of the Business Enterprise Program with the Commission for the Blind. Chair Crummell, House General Committee members. Commission for the Blind introduced this legislative concept for Senate Bill 161 as a result of recommendations from the Department of Administrative Services. This bill will provide the authority to continue the practice of not charging rent or utilities to individuals who are blind operating vending and food service facilities in state locations under ORS 346.520 through the Commission's Business Enterprise Program. The Enterprise Program provides business management opportunities in food service and vending for Oregonians who are legally blind in federal, state, and other public locations. The agency provides training for new managers, licensed, qualified blind managers, and provides ongoing technical assistance to these managers. ORS 346.510 to 346.570 encourages public buildings to lease, license, or issue a permit to the Commission for vending operating by qualified blind people. although historically the Commission for the Blind or its licensed blind operators have not been required to pay rent or utilities for food service facilities and vending machines located in public buildings. There's no law that authorizes this practice. Currently, there are 15 units operating through the Oregon Commission for the Blind in state locations. It is anticipated that because of the decrease in the number of state employees working in these buildings due to the expected layoffs resulting from the state budget shortfalls, sales revenues will be down. If these units are charged rent, utilities, and services, they would likely have to close. If this bill is not approved, DOS has notified the Commission that the current unauthorized subsidies would end on June 30, 2005. We urge your support of the bill to help maintain the employment of the Oregon blind vendors. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So, are there any questions for Mr. Milovich? Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Milovich. Thank you for being here. Groups like the deaf also operate vending machines alongside the blind?
We have, according to the law, we have the first priority. If for some reason we waiver that opportunity, then it is open to other nonprofit disabled groups.
And may I follow up and
follow up, Representative?
How we got the blind commission got the top first right to location and facility?
Basically, I think it was through the national law, the Randolph-Shepard Act, that in an early...
What act? Excuse me?
The Randolph-Shepard Act. It's a federal act that mandates vending opportunities nationwide in federal locations for blind. And the state law was based on that federal law.
So, final question. What are these funds used for?
The
income from these vending machines. Is it used for school supplies? Is it principally a training?
Yeah, a majority of the vending income goes directly to the blind managers. For their net income. That's to help supplement their income from running their deli or cafeteria operations.
And so they apply, I'm assuming various applicants apply to be the one that gets that.
Right, they go through our
each
program.
Year and you pass it around, everybody has equal opportunity.
Yeah, we train our managers and then they're placed in public facilities.
So it's really a job.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Milovich? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone? I don't have anyone else signed up. Is there anyone else that wants to testify on House Bill, Senate Bill 161? Seeing none. Excuse me. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 161. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 161. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 161A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 161A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Gina, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 161 receiving a constitutional majority is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier, do I have a volunteer? Representative Przanski has volunteered, so he will be the carrier. Thank you very much. And with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 161. I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 3617. I'm going to ask Representative Krupp and Mr. Conley, please, to come up. Representative Krupp, before you start, I'm going to have you just hang tight for a second because there's a question from Representative Przanski with regards to the relating clause to the bill and the amendment. And Representative, if you'd like to state your question better, then please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, just looking at what was handed to us as the Dash 1 amendments and looking at the relating clause relating to Homeland Defense, I noticed on the bottom of page 1, a mandate to the Department of Corrections to basically sell property. I'm trying to figure what the nexus is to the selling of real estate to homeless intent as the first part.
Chair Crummell, Representative Przanski, Harrison Connolly from the Office of Legislative Counsel. The property that we're attempting to sell and the proceeds of the property to be sold in the Dash 1 would be used for equipment and operations involved of emergency services providers involved in Homeland Security. So that would be the nexus.
Okay. Okay. Does that...
He says there's a nexus, there's a nexus.
Okay. That's fine. I just wanted to make sure that... do you have any follow-up questions relative to that?
Not at this point.
Okay. Harrison, thank you very much for coming down. Appreciate it. If you want to hang out, you're welcome to, but if you have other things to do, which I know Legislative Council is busier than busy down there, I understand, and so, but I appreciate you taking the time.
Chair, I don't enjoy being here at the dais, but once I get here, I guess I might as well stay in.
Mr. Chair, there I have one questions. More question to follow up.
Okay, Representative Vakian? Yes.
Relating to Section 2, where it says that the property to be sold is to raise proceeds of at least $600,000. If the property cannot be sold for $600,000, then does that create a problem with the relating clause with regard to the property described in Section 1?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, I don't know that I think that creates a relating clause, but it certainly does cause a practical problem in terms of affecting the intent of the bill to raise $600,000 for these purposes.
Okay. Okay. Harrison, thank you again. Representative Krupp?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I really appreciate your indulgence. Thanks for letting Harrison go, because he's going to have to draft amendments for this bill as we speak. And I'm sorry for being late, Mr. Chair. We were in the middle of substantive policy debate and voting, so I really appreciate it.
Quite all right, Representative, I understand.
For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. House Bill 3617 is a concept I came up with in regards to Homeland Defense. As you know, I have been a longtime volunteer firefighter. And public safety is an issue very, very dear to my heart. Had an opportunity to spend some time with Governor Tom Ridge a few months ago in Washington, D.C., talking about Homeland Defense issues and how first responders are the recipients of most of the Homeland Defense dollars that are available. They're made for the purposes of directly coming to first-line fire departments like mine. That leaves a bit of a gap, however, in some areas, and that's what this bill is designed to fill. There are some agencies that have been involved and actually have done a marvelous job. National Guard working with OEM, Office of Emergency Management, with the Oregon State Police, with the DEQ, with the Oregon Health Division, and others, to shortly after 9/11, they came together and they began meeting on a weekly basis, in essence, to look at homeland defense issues. Shortly thereafter, we had what's called a dirty bomb exercise. We learned some very interesting things about that, one of which was we couldn't talk to each other on the same radio frequencies. Since then, they've had a number of other exercises. They have upgraded their capacities, their capabilities to some extent. Some dollars have been made available to them, but not for the purposes of helping them meet the staffing requirements needed to ramping up for Homeland Security. And that's partly what this bill does. There are three components to this bill. This bill is a work in progress, let me be very honest with you, because right now the Oregon agencies involved in this whole Homeland Defense project at the federal level and at the state level are still in the process of assessing their needs to some extent. They have identified some of them. So we're still working through numbers with them, still trying to come up with, I guess, where those gaps really exist. The dollars that are coming, there will be some that are available. There's been some great strides. The CDC, the federal CDC, has come up with some money for the Oregon Health Division that has been passed on to other agencies to help them comply with some of the issues regarding Homeland Defense. One of the issues that we face are our DEQ lab and our Oregon Health Division lab, if you don't know this, have lost their lease at Portland State University and are having to move. I think it is a worthy concept that we should consider that they should have their own permanent lab facility, because they do have separate labs, but yet they work very well with each other.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Representative, what department, what agency?
DEQ and the Oregon Health Division have separate labs, but yet have been in the same building at Portland State University.
At Portland State.
At Portland State, and they've lost their lease. They're now having to move their facilities. This is one of the pieces that this bill is designed to fit. The first part of this bill really addresses the fact that we're going to talk about using lottery bonds for capital construction projects that may be needed for Homeland Defense. And you'll be happy to note that so far in my research and talking with the agencies involved, we really don't need much. We really have a lot of facilities already in play that we can utilize for Homeland Defense. That's a real positive. One of the biggest issues we are going to need is a lab facility at some point in time. And this bill would authorize the use of lottery bonds for Homeland Defense so that we could build a capital construction project. The second piece of this bill is what I alluded to earlier. It would be the sale of the corrections property east of town here, which has been slated for sale already. And this is a major policy change of direction, shall we say. The sale of that corrections property was previously slated, as you can see in the amendment, to go to corrections and for the Oregon Cultural Trust. What I'm proposing today is that we sell those lands, and at the direction of the chairman of this committee, who gave me a great idea, we're having an amendment drafted that we would sell the property. The property would go into what's called an Oregon Homeland Defense Trust account, and the interest earnings on that would fund FTE, any additional FTE that would be needed to fill in those gaps that I talked about for us to be able to adequately comply with Oregon, with Homeland Defense, both at the national level and the state level. The third piece of this bill imposes penalties for manufacturing and placing and detonating weapons of mass destruction with the intent to carry out terrorism. This is a piece that actually is a piece of the Indiana bill that was passed in 2001, Senate Bill 180. Many of the components that you have already passed out of this committee. You passed House Bill 2410 with the Dash 6 amendments that helps limits the liability of paramedics and people involved in emergency response to these types of terrorist attacks. The one piece that appears that we're still missing in my discussions with the Health Department specifically is the piece regarding weapons production and detonation, the use of weapons of mass destruction in the state of Oregon for the purposes of terrorism. And that's the other piece that's in this bill. You'll notice also that in the small synopsis that I gave you, we're also placing some of the dollars directly, the concept is to place some of the dollars directly from the sale of the corrections property into three areas, and that's $600,000. And let me address Representative Avakian's question. The property east of town that is slated for sale is valued in its raw form now. It is zoned EFU. It is valued at a high of $6.65 million, potentially a little higher in its current form. The E-Board directed...
$6.65 million.
Yeah. And the E-Board directed... it has potential value of $27 million. If the zoning is changed and some other issues are complied with. The E-Board has actually established that direction last year for that to occur. So there, even its rawest form, there would be more than enough money to meet the $600,000. And maybe the quick breakdown of the $300,000, and that's why this bill will be necessary, clearly, to go to Ways and Means for a number of reasons. because it is a major policy direction change in terms of where these dollars from the sale of this property was tasked for. $300,000 would go into what has been a long-established equipment revolving loan fund that we've never had any money for, because it was always slated for the general fund. And this is for small rural fire departments to be able to access that for some of their equipment needs that they've not been able to get filled. Some small rural fire departments in this state, depend on hand-me-downs from my department in terms of turnouts, in terms of SCBAs, self-contained breathing apparatus, those types of things. They don't have the money to buy that stuff. This has been something that's been on the books for a long time. We've never funded it. This is an opportunity and a way for us to fund it, especially now that not all of the Homeland Defense dollars that are coming that a fire department may be eligible for will cover all of these needs, even from Homeland Defense. But yet we are the first responders required to be able to respond to a car wreck that may have a component of a weapons of mass destruction in it. In other words, up and down I-5, the fire department that I was a member of for 12 years covered 12 miles I-5. Now, that's a major point of travel from Seattle down to Los Angeles or San Francisco. There's a lot of things move up and down our freeways that we don't know about. DOD, a lot of stuff. And we never know about that as first responders, but yet I have to go out there when a car wreck or a truck wreck happens, and I don't have chickens with me or pigeons like our troops did in Iraq to detect weapons of mass destruction. And in this age of terror, where this is, as we're being told, may be the next likely attack in this country if, heaven forbid, one happens, it may be very realistically a biochemical attack. I'm being asked as a first responder to go out there, and yet I don't have the equipment for it. I don't have the training for it. And that's what we're trying to do. We're being required in Homeland Defense. We're the people that are going to get out there first. And we have our regional hazmat teams. We have the new concepts that are being discussed in this whole group of Oregon response personnel and agencies that are trying to put the pieces together to deal effectively with Homeland Defense. This piece of $300,000 helps these small departments get there. Piece number B is $200,000 to the Volunteer Fire Association, the Chiefs Association, to help us with the training. This is ever more important since right now there's a serious move in Ways and Means to defund the Fire Marshal's Department of general fund dollars, totally. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen, but I tell you, the Fire Marshal's Department are the people that I have looked to for 12 years as a firefighter for my training. And if they're gone in that respect, who am I going to get my training from? How am I going to be able to have the training to put on a level 4 suit, protection suit, to know how to work the equipment that we may be able to buy that could be part of our standard operating procedure when you go up on a car wreck on the freeway or someplace like that? You pop open a container or you turn a diagnosis machine on and you do a quick check of the area to see what you got. We do that now for some cases, for some hazmat instances that we're required to roll up on. And those procedures and policies are going to change. We need equipment, the personnel, the ability, and training to be able to deal with it. The last piece is $100,000 to the Oregon Wing of the Civil Air Patrol. As you know, I'm a longtime pilot. I've been a member of the Civil Air Patrol. Civil Air Patrol is an auxiliary of the U.S. Air Force. They pay for most everything with the exception of our training that we do on our own. And we do that totally with volunteers. We have a hangar down in Eugene that's got a roof that's leaking on top of airplanes that the Air Force has given us to fly. We're being tasked with Homeland Defense issues. We have a lot of capability. The day after September 11th, I steps outside of my door of my home. There were no commercial aircraft flying in the United States of America. There were no private aircraft flying in the United States of America. There were two types of aircraft flying. And as I stepped out my door, I saw both of them. A Civil Air Patrol 182 delivering blood transfusion, flying south from Portland to San Francisco, and above him an F-15. That was the day after September 11th. That's what the CAP does, and they do it all with volunteers. They do it with people who spend a lot of time in training learning how to do. Right now, we have five aircraft up in the air today looking for a missing twin-engine aircraft somewhere between Wenatchee, Washington, and Klamath Falls today. Civil Air Patrol does a lot of things, and we don't get all our funding from the federal government to do these things. And we need a little help. We've been trying to get that done for a long time. That's part of what we're trying, and that's all integrated in the concept of homeland defense. Now, let me tell you what we're trying to do in terms of our amendments and why I want you to move this bill to Ways and Means. The amendment you have before you, the Dash 1, does not set up the trust account. That's being worked on right now. We are trying to, in my conversations with the Ways and Means co-chair, he is very interested in discussing this change of policy direction in regards to the sale of the corrections property to retask those dollars and what they might be used for in the future. I think that's a discussion that is a major discussion because it involves a lot of people in this building, and that's a discussion that we're going to have because a lot of dollars that have to be floated around and talked about, a lot of figures that have to be worked out in this process to be able to make that happen. And Mr. Chair, what I would ask of you and your committee members is that we move this bill in whatever form. If you don't want to adopt the Dash 1 amendments today, that's fine. If you do, that's fine also because they'll have to be integrated in the concept in some form. I would ask you move this bill to Ways and Means because your time is short as a committee, just as all committees are, policy committees. But because we have interest to make some of this policy change, I would ask that you do that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll take any questions that the committee would have.
Okay. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I'm going through the Dash 1s trying to fit that into the bill as it is. I've got a couple of questions, if I may. On page 2, line 13, it talks about having DAS engage the services of a licensed real estate broker or organization to facilitate the sale of the property. I guess my question regarding that component is, why don't we leave this in-house, allow DAS to sell property like they normally do, and actually capture more money than being on a contractual obligation of paying 6 to 8% of that cost to an outside entity where we don't, I don't see the need to having a private licensed real estate broker versus people that do this on a day-to-day basis for the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, great point, and I frankly fully agree with you. That is not a piece of the amendment that I necessarily agree with. I think there's probably language that comes from the master plan that was developed to sell this property to begin with. I'm sure there's probably some policy reason why they wanted to have real estate brokerage involved there. I think because we do dispose of other excess real property and equipment property in this state on our own, you bring up a very good point. The amount of money that we would save is substantial. And I'm going to tell you right now, just the needs that OSP has given me in terms of the people that they need to comply with Homeland Defense, a person dedicated to the Joint Terrorism Task Force with the FBI, they need one detective with equipment fully dedicated to that. That's $185,000 for the biennium. And my guess is your point is very well taken. We can save a lot of money by that, and I'd be happy to remove that.
Mr. Chair, follow up, Representative Przanski.
On the same page, starting on line 18, going through line 24, it talks about pays the cost incurred by the state for selling the property, including the cost incurred by the DOC for transferring the property. I'm kind of scratching my head because I remember the bill you brought to us before of wanting to make certain that the state police, for their use of their aircraft, to be fully compensated for the actual cost. I'm not sure how. I mean, this property is currently DOC property, and it would seem to me, the way I'm reading this, are we going to retask that money that should be DOC's and give it to someone else without giving them the fair compensation for the cost of the land that is currently under their jurisdiction for their use?
Or are we asking that this property be sold for not only above and beyond the fair market value, but in excess of $600,000, so they get their full value of the property, and then we still try to reap another benefit of another $600,000? I'm just trying to figure out what does DLC get out of this except for their out-of-pocket costs for transferring the property, if anything.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski, the agreement that was reached to sell the property previously that we would have to amend called for DOC to receive some of the dollars from the sale and the rest of it to go into the Oregon Cultural Trust. I don't know how those dollars were divided up precisely. I don't know what formula they used, but I don't know if DOC felt that they had certain needs that needed to be filled in that regard. That's why I'm telling you this is still a work in progress, and that would be one of the issues that would needed to be negotiated. And I don't know what kind of costs are incurred in terms of selling and conveying the property if we did that internally. I think the policy discussion we need to have is, what is that land worth to the state? What is its value to us today, in the future? What should it be used for in the future? What is the highest and best use of those dollars? And what I'm asking you to do is to consider the idea that Homeland Defense, having the ability to meet the real current needs of what we're being asked to do by the federal government, is not being met in our current budget environment and may not be in the future.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Follow-up.
Since you've had an opportunity to meet with the former Governor Ridge, did you have any time in that, I think you said 5 or 10 minutes, whatever it was, that you got to spend with them to talk about how much money is actually coming in to Oregon from Homeland Defense?
That is a very good question.
And asking him if they're going to actually pay for what they're mandating on us as compared to knowing the budget crisis that this state has and I think probably about 43 other states.
Excellent question, Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski. No, they're not going to pay all the money that we need to comply with Homeland Defense. The dollars that are coming to Oregon, and let me give you a breakdown of what Oregon has gotten so far. Outside of the Homeland Defense appropriation of about $4 billion, the first Homeland Defense appropriation was about $1.2 billion. Fire departments are, it was just released recently. We are now making application for that as first responder agencies. There was $8.3 million that came to Oregon. $5.8 came previous to that out of another issue for equipment. Some of it went to the state. Some of it went to cities and counties. Some of it went to some hospitals. There were some miscellaneous expenses, some planning expenses. There were some training dollars there. We've just been told as of last week there's another $13 million that's being made available. However, there are restrictions on what that money can be used for. None of that allows for any, as I am understanding it, I'm looking at my notes from having my conversations with the agencies here, none of that allows for full-time FTE, people that will need to be integrated in the daily basis and the work. You got to understand, the people that have been meeting for every week for the last year and a half have been people that have been retasked from their current jobs to be part of this thing and spent a lot of time. Last week, they were flying around in a military aircraft going on the road with what the system they've put together so far. All across the state, spent 2 days doing it. And none of that's being paid for. That's a compliance issue with Homeland Defense that the feds are not giving us money for. They are giving us money for other areas, but this is that little gap I'm trying to fill in that's so important, because I, as a first responder, can have equipment, I can have training, but if I don't know how to integrate, if I don't practice and train in training exercises with OSP or with the military department or with OEM, it isn't going to work, whether it's Homeland Defense or it's a natural disaster. It's an earthquake or a tsunami or whatever we might have. That's why we have to look at some of these issues, and we've got to. The answer is no. We've got money for some of these things, but not everything we need in terms of FTE, and we're still getting that list. And my guess is we're probably looking at maybe 10 to 12 people in total. I've got a list of six people here from OSP alone. Fortunately, I have to report to you good news in the Oregon Health Department. With some of the money they've received from the CDE, or the CDC, has hired six microbiologists. And I really give them kudos in this area, because that's going to be really important for their ability to analyze anything that we might find. That we and you all heard about the incident last week in Tacoma. They found the white powder. They went into that whole scenario. And that's the type of response system that we have to have here in Oregon. And we have to have the capability to analyze that stuff.
Okay.
That's why the lab will be so important in the future.
Thank you. Representative Mabry, did you have a question? Okay, your hand wasn't up. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you very much. Is there a reason we're not sharing the new facility with the Department of Public Safety that we're building?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, that might be an interesting idea. I think there's a lot of opportunities for that. We clearly have state property already in existence today. We will have to, I'm not sure we have any excess state buildings that we could move the labs into. It's my understanding we don't, frankly, at this point. But maybe that's an interesting side note.
Thank you. And follow-up.
Follow-up.
I'm having the same two issues, as a matter of fact, that Representative Krasinski had, but from two different viewpoints. The real estate, I'd rather not specify, if it's possible in the amendment, how the property is sold. There are certainly greater opportunities with investment bankers and other private individuals. And I just suggest that we not specify it. We have a proper, prudent appraisal. And I'm curious of why we're talking lottery bonds. There's no need to talk lottery bonds. Why you chose to say you wanted to go that direction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, another good question. I had discussions with the Treasurer's Office, and they felt this was the most appropriate area of financing that we could employ at the state level that would meet the need for capital construction.
Last follow-up, Mr.
One more follow-up.
What I'd like to do is to question the need for using the lottery bonds, in that the capacity is already extended. And if we've had permission to proceed, from the DOC, have they signed over a deed to us?
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, no. The plan that's currently in place is a long-range plan. Is that I understand the actions of the E-Board, which I have summarized here in my packet. They have put a plan in place. The property is still owned by DOC. They put a plan in place to begin rezoning the property. They think that's going to take a number of years. I would like to get confirmation of that. I would like to understand what the dynamics there are on doing that. We don't have a number of years.
I certainly rather bet on an increase in value of $27 million than lose because we're in such a hurry when there are facilities. And I encourage that option in your amendment. What you're doing is very, very important, very critical. I think the location is Umatilla, frankly, right now. And, we can build this, Homeland Defense capacity, but if you can't get Portland, Eugene, or Corvallis to support Homeland Defense needs, all's for naught, isn't it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, the local responders of those agencies, police and fire and health, are integrated into the system. They're already cooperating with OEM in this this whole system, but it's in its infancy.
Major cities that
yes, they are cooperating.
Support the federal directive early are now participating.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, those are actually two different issues. They are participating in terms of the cooperation of working together to respond to the incidents, those types of things. You're referring to the controversy that erupted in Portland.
As to determine should we have terrorists available, which we just found out we certainly do, and he's convicted. All I'm just saying is we're going to be successful in this program. Don't we need some type of coalition with the cities and counties saying, yes, we will support the efforts for which we're expending the taxpayers' money?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, great point. That is part of the system they're designing right now, is exactly that very thing.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Representative Worth?
Mr. Chair, since we've established the financial support from the federal government to date has not been enough to help us fully comply with the Homeland Security defense, do we have an idea of the cost that it would be for full compliance?
Well, yes, we do. It's a number that's in flux for a lot of reasons. The number that's to be given to me, and this is a concept called complete interoperability. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that means. I think it's a... I think it's a pretty far-out concept, I guess, for lack of a better term. It's a great goal. I'm not sure we can achieve it. The figure is around $800 million. And I'm not in any way deluding myself to think that we'll ever get enough money from the federal government to do that. So what we have to do, Representative, is work backwards from that. And that is look at what we can do with what we've got now and what we're going to get in the next 2 years. For instance, we need what's called a little black box for $50,000. You go on scene. It's a box about this big, and you plug in all of your radios from your various agencies. And in essence, ties them all together. $50,000 for that little black box. Those are some of the equipment needs that we have. And so $800 million for radios that everybody can use and we can all talk to each other at the same time, the complete integration, you know, $800 million, I don't see that we'll ever get there from the federal government.
Mr. Chair. Yes. I really need to cut this off because we need to move on. We've got several other bills that we need to get through in about 7 minutes. Representative Worth, can you be brief?
I have a really quick question. I'm wondering, since most of this financing goes through OEM in your proposal, why not just allow the OEM, why not just funnel extra money, lottery back bonds, and the sale of this corrections property into OEM? Is there a lack of confidence in OEM's ability to allocate or respond appropriately so as to the need to set up this special fund?
Mr. Chair and Representative Worth, in relation to the lottery bonds would be issued for, it would be something outside of OEM because it would be issued for the purposes of building a physical structure. The Homeland Trust account could be one of those things where we dedicate the proceeds of the sale to corrections in the trust account to be used at some future date. But the interest earnings would go to pay for the FTE that we need to comply with Homeland Defense, these 10 or 12 people that I've been talking about. That would be the concept. In regards to the split off of the other dollars, clearly if we go to Ways and Means, I don't have any illusions that my concept here is going to survive intact in Ways and Means, because a lot of people will want to take shots at it. A lot of people want to modify portions of it, and that's fine because that's what that process is for. Some serious numbers need to be worked here if this concept is to be considered viable in any way. But I frankly have every confidence in OEM because they have proven to me, at least in my meetings with them, the dollars that they've distributed already and Health Department and all these other agencies, they've done a heck of a job for the little amount of money they've had. Okay. I'm real proud of them.
Thank you. Representative Krasanski.
Mr. Chair, at your request, I'm making a motion that we move House Bill 3617 to Rules Committee.
Thank you. Representative Przanski has moved House Bill 3617 to the Rules Committee. My suggestion here is that we look upon this favorably. We're not put any of the amendments in,
right,
and that we make no recommendation. But that gives, because rules will be open longer than our committee will, it does give Representative Krupp the opportunity to work the idea and solidify some more of these concepts before we close down. And I'd like to give him, I think there's some merit here, I'd like to give him the opportunity to do that. And the sort of the information that I feel that I'm getting from the committee is that there's some ideas here, but they need some percolation time, and we don't get that in this committee. So because we really need to with this particular bill, we need to fish or cut bait, and so I'm suggesting we send it to rules and let them deal with it. Any other discussion on the motion? Gina, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The House Bill 3617 then is moved to the Rules Committee without recommendation. And Representative Krupp,
you can work
it there. Thank
really
you very
appreciate
much for your
it.
Attention.
Thank you for your attention.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3617. I'm going to open a works public hearing on House Bill. Senate Bill 250. While Gina's getting us the list, do you want to give us a rundown on this, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 250A authorizes state agencies to utilize the performance reporting information system, also known as PRISM, to measure workforce performance. It prohibits state agencies and organizations participating in the Interagency Shared Information System, also known as SIS, from providing new information to that system after December 1st, 2003.
Okay, great. We have with us Graham Slater. Graham, come on up. And
I can't remember who I was talking to.
Take a seat.
Mr. Chair, members.
Start whenever you're ready.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Excuse me, just a second. You need to keep the noise down over on this side. If you want to talk, either go outside or go back in the corner, please. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks very much for the chance to testify this morning. For the record, my name is Graham Slater, the Research Administrator with the Employment Department, and you have in front of you a two-page handout about this bill. It makes just two or three small changes to existing statute, all things that we think are important to us, but minor, certainly compared with some of the things you've been hearing. I'm going to hit very brief highlights, knowing your time frames here. Back in 1993, the legislature created the Shared Information System. It took a group of state agencies a number of years to work through all the confidentiality and legal issues. And just about the time that that shared information system was up and running, the Workforce Investment Act passed at the federal level, changed some of what was needed from this workforce performance system. So 2 years ago, Senate Bill 400 allowed the Employment Department to start developing this new system that meets the needs of the workforce boards, the Workforce Investment Act, and so on. At this point, because of all the work done over those prior years, we didn't have to rethink much of that stuff. So we do have reports coming out of PRISM, the Performance Reporting Information System, and what we're proposing right now is to gradually sunset the first of those, the Shared Information System, and shift the performance responsibility to PRISM. The effects at the bottom of page one there, the three main things, is that it starts the process of shutting down the shared information system. It names the performance reporting information system as the system that will be used for Oregon's workforce measures. And it also allows greater flexibility in PRISM. Right now, it's very difficult for us to allow different workforce agencies, either public or private sector, to become part of this measurement system. If you turn the page, you'll just see very quickly three examples of the kind of information that we can get out of PRISM. If you think it's important for us to know whether people served by government employment and training agencies actually find jobs when they're all done, or if they stay employed, or if their wages increase, that's what PRISM's all about. It's just a way for us to know that people through community colleges or the employment department or wherever else are actually being successful in the workforce once they're done. Senate Bill 250 represents a bunch of government agencies working together, represents collaboration. It particularly represents avoidance of duplication. In other words, we're coming to you saying we don't need the shared information system anymore. We just need to replace it. We don't want to spend money on two different things. The concepts in the bill have been reviewed by all the partners, the customers, and so on. No negative impact on the stringent confidentiality requirements, no fiscal impact, because by passing it, we will not have to run two systems, and based on some discussions with the Senate, no general fund monies will be used by the four partner agencies in this coming biennium.
Okay.
Be happy to take questions.
Any questions for Mr. Slater? Seeing none, then thank you, Mr. Slater. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 250? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 250. I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 250. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 250A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 250A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Gina, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 258, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do I have someone to carry it? Representative Wirth, would you like to carry it? Okay. Representative Wirth will be the carrier of this bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Slater. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 250. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 692 and ask Patrick to give us a rundown on this bill, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 692A authorizes the governing body of a county with consent of the county treasurer to make service districts directly responsible for management of monies of the service district.
Thank you. We have with us Gerald Kubiak from Washington County.
Good morning,
Gerald.
Chair.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Chair Crummell, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me a couple of minutes. I'll be brief. It's our thought that this bill is pretty straightforward and relatively limited in scope. The Washington County Board of Commissioners serves in an additional capacity. It's the Board of Directors for the Clean Water Services Agency, which is a county service district that provides stormwater services for most Washington County residents. It also does a range of other functions, including water quality and stream enhancement projects. The issue that has prompted us to pursue this bill is the fact that statute presently requires county governing bodies, boards of commissions or courts, and the county administrative structure to provide the treasury functions for county service districts. And given that we've got a governing body that jointly administers and oversees these two different agencies, it has, at the local level, these are locally elected folks that are accountable for the performance of these two separate agencies. However, their hands are tied, so to speak, presently by statute, given that it directs them to perform, it directs the county to perform the treasury functions for the service district. What we suggest and what we've forwarded here in Senate Bill 692 is revision of statute that's permissive in nature and relatively limited. It addresses those situations where boards of commissioners double as board of directors for a service district. It enables those county governing bodies to authorize the district to perform its own treasury functions. And I guess with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Questions, Representative Mabry.
This is permissive, but is it permissive for the county governing body to require that a district manage their own treasury function?
Chair Crummell, Representative Mabry, no, it does not. It does not direct counties to change current practices whatsoever. It simply makes that adjustment available to the county governing body if it deems it appropriate.
So, follow up, Representative. So then, if I'm a special district out there that has very, very limited things, it's not likely. Does not allow the county court to say we don't like you anymore. Therefore, we're done with you.
Indeed. Chair Crummell, Representative Mabry, that's correct. And I guess I would reiterate that this change applies only to those county governing bodies that are also the board of directors for the service district agency. So there's an existing process in place for the administrators to communicate with their elected officials. and it's the anticipation that this wouldn't be done unless there was a comfort level on both the part of the county and the district. As is the case in Washington County, both agencies are comfortable with this change, and we would go ahead and do this if we got legislative approval.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Are you Gerald?
I am.
Kubiak?
Yes, correct.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Mr. Kubiak for just helping me in the face of this personal emergency just now.
And okay.
I appreciate it. And what if the county treasurers are not elected? There's another bill to have them appointed, the county treasurer and the assessor, and how would this bill work?
That's correct. Representative Crummell, Chair Crummell, Representative Nelson, as is the case, and I think in most counties, treasurer is an appointed position. So in those counties, the treasurer does not have a role in making this determination. Only when the treasurer is an elected official, this change must be done with the approval of the elected treasurer. So any other changes to statute would channel down into this, and this mechanism would still work similarly. If we eventually have all appointed treasurers, that will effectively be a moot point in terms of the way it's addressed by this particular bill.
Then we'd have to come back in 10 years and amend this bill.
Okay. So Mr. Chair, if the other bill passes it, I think we're going to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I want to understand. So if, like it was Deschutes County that wants to appoint, or was one, I think,
correct,
appoint the county treasurer and county assessor. So until they change their home rule to making it elected treasurers, they cannot have a special district that was overseen by the treasurer.
Chair Crummell, Representative Nelson, if I may, I would clarify that the treasurer is involved in this determination only if he or she is elected, and if the treasurer in a given county is an appointed position, this change may still be made. It's just the decision lies solely with the county governing body, so it doesn't limit a jurisdiction in that sense whatsoever. It only seeks to be responsive to if there's a situation where there is an elected treasurer, that individual is involved in this decision-making process.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Thanks, Gerald. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 692-8? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing and we're not going to work session. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 692-8 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves Senate Bill 692-A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Gina, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 692A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Avakian, how about if you carry this one? That would be terrific. Thank you very much. And I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 692A. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 724. And while Gina's getting us the list, I'm going to ask Patrick to give us a rundown on this.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 724A allows a city or county 45 days instead of 30 days to consider an application for issuance of a new Oregon Liquor Control Commission license before making a recommendation to the commission on whether the new license should be issued. It allows the commission to extend by 30 days an existing temporary authority to operate.
Can you do that? While you do that, I'll ask Mr. He has been. Okay. John, you want to go ahead and come on up? John Steubenbaugh and... I don't care which one of you starts, but please go.
Representative Carmel, I'm Don Bischoff, legislative assistant to Senator Bill Morissette, who apologizes for his absence, but he's had to go to the floor. Senate Bill 724 is a bipartisan bill. It was co-sponsored by Senator Farioli and Senator Morissette to give local jurisdictions more time to act on applications for OLCC licenses. It passed the Senate 25-2. The bill is based on a recommendation from the governor's OLCC interim task force, in which Senator Farioli and Morissette both served. The task force felt that it's needed because the current 30-day time limit on local action for local action on OLCC applications doesn't allow enough time for cities and counties to consult with neighborhood groups and others who might have an interest in the applications to take action and then notify the OLCC of their position. Originally, the bill called for extending the time limit to 60 days, but it was amended to 45 days in the Senate General Government Committee to meet concerns of the Oregon Restaurant Association, and the 45-day limit is a compromise. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Let me go ahead and have Mr. Steubenvold speak, and then I'll open the panel up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. My name is John Steubenvold. I'm the Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. This bill really is a compromise that comes to you from the Senate, but we still feel it's a very good improvement in the liquor licensing process. Quite simply, it allows 45 days as opposed to 30 days for local governments to consider a recommendation on a new liquor license application. Now, we feel the increased time is appropriate, not only because it allows cities with active neighborhood associations, active citizen involvement in their decision-making, ample time to fully consider and make a fully informed recommendation on a liquor license to the OLCC. It also allows an applicant for a new liquor license who may have some issues with that local government an increased period of time to work out those issues with the local government before that recommendation comes to the OLCC. So clearly, we view this as an improvement to the process because it allows more time for citizen involvement at the local level, and it also would allow more time for an applicant to work out any issues with the local government before the recommendation comes to the OLCC. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Worth, you had a question.
He answered it.
Okay. Representative Kitts.
I'd like to declare a potential conflict. I am currently going through this process. So okay. That's why I want to say that. The 45 days, I talked to the city of Salem, who I originally had to go through, I thought. Turns out it was the county. They both told me that 99% of the time, they just place these on the consent calendar and just stamp them through. It has to go through two meetings for approval, not just one, before it goes. You get approved by the OLCC. Your site gets posted. It's posted for 10 days. If at that time no complaints are heard, it then goes to the city. The city has to hear it twice. If no complaints are heard, it then goes back to the OLCC, and it falls in line with everyone else that's gone through that, and it's heard by the OLCC for the second time and then approved if no snags come up. My question is, if it's on the consent calendar, in as I was told by the city of Salem, 90%+ of the time, why do they need an additional 2 weeks? I want to make sure that we're not being, obstructionist here to folks obtaining their liquor license. You know, it's obviously a big cost, but it's an economic, indicator for small businesses. So I just would like clarification on why they need an additional 2 weeks.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, thank you for the question. Certainly, we at OLCC recognize the importance of issuing a liquor license, especially a new liquor license, in a prompt period of time. That's why we have concerns about staffing levels that are currently under discussion. At the same time, we feel that being able to work out any potential issues at the local level before they get to the OLCC level for final approval certainly is a more effective and efficient way to deal with things. Because if a city government would raise an issue, a substantive issue with a new liquor license, and bring that concern to the OLCC, it's going to be much more difficult and take longer time, typically, to work out once that issue reaches the OLCC level. So we fully appreciate that there's some concerns over two more weeks at the local level, as this bill would call for. At the same time, it does give you the opportunity, or it gives a liquor license applicant the opportunity, to work out those issues before they reach the OLCC.
May I have one quick follow-up? How long has it been set at 30 days?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kidd, since the 1999 Legislative Assembly passed legislation, which was effective January 2001, so it's been 2 years.
And just quick follow-up. Prior to that, what was it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, there was no time limit prior to that.
So cities and counties could drag their feet for as long as they... Let me rephrase that. I stated my conflict of interest prior to this. So prior to that, cities or counties could take as long as they so chose.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, yes.
Thank you.
I believe, though, in clarification on that, I believe that the statute before the 30 days was put in called for it to be that applications had to be moved in a timely fashion. But timely was definitely determined by the local government. But they couldn't just be obstructionist either. And so there was always that limitation. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 724A? Christy? You're going to be brief, right?
Very brief.
Brief as possible. Christy Munson for the League of Oregon Cities. Just wanted to note, point of interest for the committee, that sometimes, and not most of the time, we have big operations coming in which we need to research out-of-state owners, et cetera. So there are some times when cities need to do additional research, and it takes that extra time.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
I promise to be quick. My understanding is the OLCC does the background, not the cities.
Each city handles Chair Cummerill, Representative Kitts, each city handles it differently. Some cities take the research upon themselves.
So it could feasibly, a background check could feasibly be done twice?
Feasibly.
That's correct. Okay, thank you. Anyone else that wishes to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 724A. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 724A.
Mr. Chair, move
Representative Krasanski.
SB 724A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krasanski moves Senate Bill 724A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Kitts.
Is it appropriate that I vote on this because I'm directly affected, or should I abstain?
It is no problem for you to vote on it. What I would like you to do, though, is one more time, because now we're in work session, is go ahead and state your potential conflict of interest.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I have a conflict of interest as I am currently in this process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krasanski.
Point of clarification, this bill will not go into effect until after he hopefully has its liquor license and serving.
In a timely fashion.
That is correct. Thank you. Speaking from a local government perspective, I can tell you that some applications move through very quickly and others don't. With that, Gina, call the roll, please.
Note to self.
Aye.
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 Senate Bill 724A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed on the floor of the due pass recommendation. Representative Mabry,
sure.
Since you're a former local government guy, would you like to carry?
Old was the right phrase.
Representative Mabry, you will carry. I'm going to close the work session on 724A, and with that, we will stand adjourned until Thursday.
Thank you very much.